Hi, everyone. I'm Davey Jarrell, and welcome to another episode of the Animation Resources podcast series, Animated Discussions. I'm an animator and storyboard artist, currently storyboarding on a new show at Nickelodeon, and I also serve as the director of programming for Animation Resources. Animation Resources is a 501c3 nonprofit that specializes in art curation. We preserve art from the past so it can be used to inform art of the future. If you're not already, I highly encourage you to become a member of Animation Resources. Paying members get access to a new reference pack every other month. Reference packs include rare animated cartoons, movies, illustrations, and also content that provides context, like ebooks and this podcast series. If you're a student, it costs $70 per year to be a member, and for everyone else, it's $95 per year. There's also a quarterly membership, which is $30 every 3 months. You can sign up right now at animationresources.org/membership. One more time, that's animationresources.org/membership. My two guests on today's episode are animation educator and fellow board member Tabor Dunapace and animation producer and president of Animation Resources, Stephen Wirth. Today's podcast is called, Is Using Reference Constructive or a Crutch? Let's get started. The whole philosophy of Animation Resources really leads directly into today's topic, which is the many ways artists can use reference. And we've divided up the uses for reference into two main categories. One is reference for practical purposes. Say, for example, you need to animate a quadruped. Don't just make it up out of your head. Go out and find reference. And the other category is more general, using reference that has no immediate application other than simply to expose yourself to it. It's a more conceptual use for reference. So first, Tabor is going to talk about the first method, finding and using reference for direct application. And Tabor, as a teacher, what is your main focus in broaching the topic of using reference to your students?
Usually it's a fairly natural thing to discuss in courses because I'm teaching them to do something they've never done before. And so they need an example. Sometimes I am directly the reference. Follow along with me, do as I demonstrate, and then their output is exactly the same as my output if everything goes according to plan. And so that is an early kind of reference. Then our assignments tend to go into, I want you to, like, let's say, paint a landscape. And they get panicked looks on their face. And I say, no, it's fine. Look up pictures of landscapes. And then rather than just painting one of them, why not look up several pictures of landscapes and get the mountains from one and the hills from another and a log cabin from a third one. And so it's a really natural kind of progression into using reference. But it doesn't last because as soon as I'm not there telling them, you need to look up pictures of this or that and use them to influence your work, they stop doing it. They think somehow that it's a bad thing or that they're cheating if they do work that they care about, that they've used reference for. It's a really bizarre thing that happens.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm not even sure how to explain it, why this happens, but like, let's say we're designing a cartoon character and they're working in a kitchen. They won't look up what chef uniforms look like. And I can't imagine why not, because I don't know what a chef uniform looks like necessarily, but that character is going to need to wear one. Or they won't necessarily look up what are, you know, industrial kitchen supplies. So maybe they could hold those kinds of things in their hand or they're going to interact with those. And all of it's just kind of obvious to me is that I don't have a perfect reference library of objects in my head. I need to use some research, a little bit of Googling things, a little bit of experience in order to make all that stuff work properly. Mm-hmm. So it's really bizarre, but yeah, that's the attitude I get, that the more they care about it, the more they want it to be theirs, the less likely they are to look up anything at all.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So they're afraid they're going to copy? Do you think that's the hesitation?
Yeah, I think maybe that's a part of it. A part of it is that it doesn't feel like it's theirs unless they imagine it whole cloth, which is kind of a misnomer anyway. I mean, nobody imagines anything whole cloth. I remember a lecture way back from one of the concept artists on Men in Black, where they kept asking him to make aliens that looked like nothing you've ever seen before. And he said, yeah, I think you know what I'm going to say. Like, that's a silly thing to ask, because then it's just static. If it looks like nothing you've ever seen before, it doesn't look like an animal or a person or a plant or anything. And so what he said in his lecture is like, well, no, I take things that are familiar and combine them in unfamiliar ways. Mm. That way it hits that uncanny valley kind of like scary part where it's a man-eating piranha plant or something. It's like, It's like two or three things that you've seen before. So I think that's part of it, that if they don't invent it whole cloth, they think somehow it doesn't belong to them. It's not theirs, which is absolutely not true. And the other part is that they don't want to cheat somehow. They don't want to copy. They don't want to plagiarize, right? But yeah. I don't think they really, I mean, it's very sweet that they think they're going to plagiarize accidentally, but I don't think they really know what plagiarism is.
So where do you draw the line between referencing and plagiarism?
Yeah. If you completely reproduce something exactly as it appears in the thing that you're looking at, then you're copying it. But not necessarily plagiarizing it if you don't pass it off as your own. If you don't say, I made this, then you're not plagiarizing. You're doing a master copy. And that's completely normal and completely realistic to do, especially if you're trying to learn how to reproduce the look of some artist's work. Mm-hmm. Copy their work, right? I did that for about a month a couple years ago with Calvin and Hobbes, because I wanted to learn how Bill Watterson did his cartoon drawings, and just meticulously, carefully copied out every little bit. And it was a great learning experience, but I wasn't saying I drew Calvin and Hobbes. I was just drawing what he drew. Mm-hmm. And so that's perfectly fine. If you sell it, you're in big trouble. Don't sell it, right? Don't charge anything for it. Don't claim it as your own. Don't sign your name on it. But other than that, you're fine.
Don't put it in your portfolio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, 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 no. No, you should use what you learn to put it in a portfolio.
You know, Tabor, you mentioned the term master copy, mm-hmm. and that's something that goes way back in the traditions of art. In the current reference pack that I just finished working on, that's going up next weekend, I believe, we have an ebook of Hokusai manga. Hokusai was not only the greatest artist that Japan ever produced, but he's come to become regarded as one of the greatest artists in the entire history of art. He kept sketchbooks where he'd draw things that he'd see in the everyday world. He'd use these for his reference. You know, we have Google. He had to go out and actually draw them into books.
Yeah.
But the one primary use was to share these drawings with his students. And their job would be to copy his drawings and learn how Hokusai constructed his drawings, his methods of simplifying figures and stylizing them, How to maintain the guts and energy in a pose. And by copying his work, they absorbed his thought process. They didn't imitate him.
Yeah. And that's a great way to learn from someone that you admire, someone whose work you enjoy. And just about everyone who gets into art or animation has something that they really enjoy, but what they tend to do is just rote copy it over and over and over again. And so you get, you know, mountains of work that are created, but not towards any particular goal. They think that the process of learning is just going to do itself somehow, but that's not really how that works. You have to analyze it. You have to break it apart. You have to learn what parts you can do well, what parts you can't do well, and then push your ability in those various ways. And in a way, that's sort of what we're trying to get people to do with the Preston Blair Bearhead, is not draw like it's the 1940s, but draw what they're drawing so that you can understand what skills go into it and build your ability and understand and broaden your concept of what good animation drawing is. Hmm. Mentioning Hokusai is really great because sketchbooks are a tremendously good reference resource that anybody can have and anybody can use. Just recently when my quarter started, I brought a giant stack of my sketchbooks into the classroom because I'm teaching anatomy. And it's kind of a frustrating topic because it's so specific and very, very demanding. And so I showed them from the earliest classes that I ever took, my sketchbooks, where the drawings are atrocious. It was awful, honestly. And then one or two sketchbooks per year from that point on, all the way up, I think it went like 7 or 8 years. And so I just had a huge table filled with sketchbooks. And so I did it to show them, for one thing, you should do this because it helps your memory. It helps your recognition of things that are interesting or important to you. It's a great way to take notes. It's a great way to just have a little bit of fun and draw something in your downtime. But also, it's just your constant companion, this sketchbook, where if you're wanting to do a little bit of design work or a little bit of ideation and you're at the DMV for half an hour, well, crack that baby open and do a little bit of pleasant work instead of staring at the walls or listening to music. You know, it's a way nicer way to pass the time. Hmm. And in the meantime, you get to sort of just idly refresh your memory on the things that happened recently and things that you've been pondering about and take down notes. And my sketchbooks ended up looking like I was a, you know, serial killer, because there's diagrams and notes everywhere to which way, and then drawings of butts flying away with halos and things. It's maddening, but it's also really entertaining to look back at, because I can remember with more clarity than any other time in my life what was going on when I was making those drawings in that sketchbook, because it was sort of reinforcing those daily events. So I would see something like, you know, a person who walked funny, and I'd draw it. It was great.
So it was a very personal visual time capsule.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're actually creating your own reference that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we were encouraged to go into public and draw people who wouldn't hold still for us and didn't know we were drawing them. And it was really intimidating until we realized everybody's still in their own world. They never notice. But I would go further than that, because animation was my primary study. I would follow them and like mimic how they walked and mimic their posture. And my friends would always like tell me not to, because I was going to get in trouble.
I got in trouble for that once.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fun. But every now and then they notice.
You mentioned a few minutes ago about when you're using reference, you'll suggests taking parts from different images.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah. Well, I think it helps to alleviate the fear that if you use reference, you're going to be plagiarizing or copying, but also it sort of just frees you up to be more experimental and creative with whatever it is that you're looking at. So you could take anything from a character to an object or a vehicle. Let's take a building, for instance, like a pizzeria. So you look on, you know, Google Images for pizzeria buildings, and you see a whole bunch, and there's nothing really catching your eye. Maybe there is one and you like their sign, but you don't like anything else. So then you can just type in like brownstone apartment buildings. Find one that you like. Do you like the bricks? Do you like the colors? Whatever it is, put that on the stack of reference. Maybe there's nothing interesting happening on the roof or in the windows. Do some more searches for different kind of things. Find pictures that inspire you, and now you're making a collage of all of those different elements put together into your design. Not only that, you're not stuck with how they look. You can change their proportions a little bit. You can change their colors. You can change their position, anything you want. This is something I frequently see employed for painters. Painters oftentimes will take photographic reference of models that are acting out the actions that they want to do. I mean, realist painters will. And then they will just sort of cobble it together into a scene that they are then going to paint as their final result. Hmm. Concept artists do this a lot as well, because the emphasis is not on the high quality of art, but rather on the ideas and the design. And so it's a great way to work. I think it really frees you up to focus on what's more interesting, which is how are you presenting all this stuff and what are you trying to say? Are you trying to say this pizzeria is a rundown junk hole with rats everywhere? Are you trying to say that it's this idyllic palace of pizza where people go practically like it's church to have this religious experience with this delicious pizza pie? I don't know what it is you're trying to say, but find those elements that feed your vision. And then you can make a pizza place that never existed before, but is uniquely your idea.
That takes it beyond just being like a magpie, mm-hmm. where you're creating collages, mm-hmm. and makes it your own thing.
Yeah.
It's almost what would happen in your brain naturally. You've seen signs for restaurants. You've seen the restaurants themselves. You've seen media that has pizzerias in it. And all of that is combining in your head to give you an idea. But this now sort of codifies it and says, okay, let's... all of that's great. Go look at actual images and then pick specific bits too and add that in, and it becomes even richer.
Yeah. Would you say that another way to analyze reference would be to simplify it, to maybe just like capture the essence?
Sometimes, yes. It depends on what you're trying to get the reference for. So sometimes you could care about the details in the image that you're looking at, say what kind of buttons are on a doctor's lab coat or something like that. Sometimes you would care about the colors, only the colors, and it's going to be used for something completely different. So you see a, an interesting, you know, painted sign and think, oh, I'm going to make this cool, like, you know, 1960s, you know, mystery machine, Volkswagen bus, and I want this mural on it, and I love those paintings, so I'm going to stick that on there. Simplifying makes a lot of sense when it's for caricature and exaggeration, but it depends on what it is you're trying to say, really. So yeah, if I saw, for instance, a very heavy set guy, I might say, oh, the widest part of his body is center chest instead of hips, and so now I have this barrel shape that I'm thinking of when I'm trying to make my heavy set character, or I might shift that a little bit. So yeah, I definitely like that.
So it's really a combination.
Yeah.
You're taking the essence of things. Sometimes you're taking details. Sometimes you're taking composition.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're taking color.
The important part is that you're pushing it further into a caricature, which is making it your own.
Right.
I have a quote that I memorized that is by Joseph Conrad. And the quote is, "A caricature is putting the face of a joke on the body of the truth." And you're right. It's the essence of finding out what that pizza parlor is and then emphasizing it to make it a specific kind of pizza parlor.
Right.
And when you see a cartoon drawing of it, you might laugh, but you know that it's also something totally real as well.
Yeah. And I think the funniest things tend to have that element of truth to them. It's not just poking fun at something you hate. I've heard it said that you can't really mock something that you hate, that you just revile because there's no humor in it. I'm not sure if that's true, but I find that there's an element, like, even in like the celebrity personalities that I really can't stand, I can't stand them in a specific way that is memorable to me and that I kind of want more of, you know?
So maybe it's a love-hate relationship you have when you are caricaturing something.
Yeah.
And making fun of.
Absolutely.
Do you have advice for people who are trying to do something that doesn't exist? Like finding reference for something where there is no reference?
Yeah. So if you're making a spaceship out of cardboard, for instance, well, there's no reason why that couldn't exist, but it definitely wouldn't function. But you would have to think up, how should this work? How could this work? And come up with like bespoke parts that could somehow magically work together. Well, a trip to Home Depot would be great for that. Right. You go and look at like the ducting or go look at the plumbing section or something and think, does this look spacey enough? Could this conceivably, in a cartoon world, of course, work for different kinds of space shuttle stuff? And oh, speaking of space shuttle stuff, what are space shuttle stuff? Like, what is that? Maybe I should look at an actual rocket and figure out what are those things that are going on the outside? What are the functional bits of it so that I can even have a place to start with my imagined rocket or space shuttle. So everything that is imagined, I think, from a place of things that are real put together, things that are real that are exaggerated or shifted or changed. We don't tend to imagine something that is so alien that we can't even describe it in words, right? A talking, dancing, singing pizza slice, right? It's a pizza slice is a person. Okay. So what do we do with that? We can make the thing its head, we could make it its entire body, we could use pepperonis or mushrooms for different facial features. It's sort of a puzzle, right? It's less of a imagine something in a vacuum with absolutely no idea of where it's going, but more of like, I have these requirements now to fulfill. It needs to dance and sing and be a person, but also be a pizza. So how do I solve that problem? You're just sort of joining it from both sides. From the animation side, I have some interesting solutions that I've tried before, which are pretty fun. If you're animating something like, say, it's a ninja character wall running and backflipping, you could look for human beings who are doing those kinds of things, like parkour or Ninja Warrior on television or whatever it was, that sort of stuff. That's fine. But they might not do the thing that you want. It might be at an angle that you can't see. There's a lot of problems that can arise from that. But in terms of like the mechanics of how that works, that's great. If you want the specific timing and spacing reference, you could just puppet it with like a bright ball on the end of a stick. and this is something I have my students do quite a lot, that we film. We love to film ourselves for reference, but we can't do that sort of thing. So I film it and I say, in your imagination, try to close your eyes and imagine the scene playing out. This ninja is going to run, 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 jump, 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 flip, and land. Try to play it full speed in your imagination. And then with this stick, act it out on invisible, you know, walls and landscape. And we'll film you acting it out like 5-6 times. And if you're imagining it and just kind of like playing that game that we used to play as kids, looking out the car window and you're flying like spaceships out the window in your imagination, you're going to get pretty good timing reference out of that. Mm-hmm. You might even get pretty good spacing reference out of it if you're good at controlling the stick with the little ball in the end. Mm-hmm. And I found that regularly it made their animation process way easier because they had solved some questions of staging, some questions of how many frames it was going to take, some questions of how many actions were going to be performed just by kind of playing toys in front of a camera. So I love doing that.
That's always a great idea, to manifest the action that you're trying to animate like physically before actually animating it.
Yeah.
You know, rather than coming up with it out of thin air.
Well, and you could go back and forth. Like, you could draw storyboards first and then act it out.
Yeah.
Or you could act it out first, then draw your poses.
Right.
Anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, when I learned CG character animation in school, we always had to film ourselves doing the action before we animated the scene.
Right.
But how do you find good reference if you're a bad actor?
This is something I found immediately when I started filming reference. I was okay being in front of the camera. I set it running, forget it's there. You don't stop and start the camera. You just run the camera, leave it alone. That makes people more comfortable to actually perform in front of it, right? Mm-hmm. But just by asking people to walk in front of the camera, they would do things like twin their hand and their foot together at the same time, like they were a marionette on accident. They were just too self-conscious. They couldn't get over it. So you'd have someone walking along with their right foot and right hand coming forward and their left foot and left hand. And I'd say, what are you doing? Just walk. And they're like, I am just walking. Like, no, you're not. You're being a maniac. So if you can't act it out, you could have friends that can act it out, right? Or you could take some acting reference from something that already exists. So a celebrity performance you could look at. Now, that might get tricky because it's specifically whatever that scene is. But if you're good at getting sort of their mannerisms and maybe their body shapes or emphasis on how they say their dialogue, maybe that would help. Or you can imagine the scene how you would like it to play out and then try to get your reference piecemeal. So by that, I mean, don't try to act it out. Try to pose it and take photographs of yourself. So you're not acting it out. You're just trying to get the specific beats, the specific emphasis and body language. The vocal performance can be separate from that. You're going to marry it all together anyway. It depends on how complicated it is, but you don't have to just be this great actor all in one go performing your entire scene. That would be quite a lot to ask even of a professional actor.
Yeah.
So occasionally what I would do is, and this is, you know, classic animators have a mirror, right? And are looking at their face and their body in the mirror. So I would just make the camera play. And instead of acting out the scene, I would try to act out like pointing in an accusing, haughty way. And I would just do that for like a minute and a half, just a pointing. So maybe I'd turn away and I'd turn around and point, or then I'd like loosen up and I'd try to point again, or I'd try to feel especially angry and point. And when I go and look back at it, little bits of it would be inspirational. I go, oh, look what I'm doing with my leg every time. Look what's happening to my shoulder that I didn't realize, right? Look what's happening to my neck. Every time I make that jab, this thing happens with my neck, and I should make sure to include that. So I'd have all of these notes about this one gesture. Hmm. And then you could do that for a bunch of them. So it's the same sort of idea as putting a collage together for a painting. Now you're putting a collage together for an acted scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, this is about putting pieces together.
Yeah.
Hope it says something coherent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be this step you have to do, this thing you drag yourself through. It's an aid, right? It's there to help you, to assist you. You're trying to make your scene
part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great inspirational part of the ideation and of the design. It should be a big, big boon to do it. and solve a lot of your problems and sort of clear the way towards doing the really hard work, which is, you know, producing the animation itself or producing all of the storyboard panels yourself.
Yeah.
In that article that I linked up in whatever channel that was, I think it was Animation Talk, it was about animating a horse. And I remembered that there was an anecdote in not only the Animator Survival Kit, but Illusion of Life, about how they would spend lots and lots of time, maybe even a week or several days, on their preparatory steps for their scene. So that by the time they actually started animating their scene, it was almost all set what they were going to do. They'd cleared the path for themselves. There was no more question of how many frames is it going to take. There was no more question of what sort of emotional beats they were going to hit or what sort of body language they were going to use, because all of that preparatory work was what that was. Mm. And now it was just delivering on it, which I think is a great way to work.
It's easier than starting with a blank slate.
The funny story that goes with that is Freddie Moore. Mm. Freddie Moore was always in trouble at the studio for wandering around and interrupting other artists while they were trying to work. He had a trailer on the lot, and he'd wake up at about 10:30 in the morning, and he'd get out and get a cup of coffee, and then he'd go see one animator and hang out in his office for a few minutes, and then off to another one and kibitz with him for a while.
Yeah.
Then he'd go to a 3-cocktail lunch and come back and hang out a little bit more with some people. And then at 5 o'clock, he'd finally go back to his trailer and go into a frenzy of animation and would knock out an entire scene in an hour.
Wow.
And they realized what he was doing was he was acting out little bits in everybody's office and seeing their reactions.
Oh, wow.
And as he was just shooting the breeze all day long, was what it looked like, but what he was actually doing was he was being Mickey Mouse in front of the entire staff.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I find a similar thing happens every now and then where I've got a project that's long term and I can't work on it till the end of the day because of whatever reason. All day long, my head is sort of in that space. I'm thinking about it a little bit here and there. Go and get lunch and I'm kind of daydreaming about it. You know, driving home, I daydream about it a little bit more. And if that happens all day, at the end of the day, not only am I voraciously ready to work on that thing, but I've got a lot of very concrete ideas about what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that sounds really familiar, although his way of doing it is pretty amazing.
Since you've now talked a lot about how to use reference, mm-hmm. I now want to ask you, before I move on to Steve's portion, what are some ways not to use reference?
Ah.
When is it ever a bad thing?
If you are just copying something for its own sake, for the sake of copying, potentially that can be bad if you're not intending to learn something from it or appreciate it on a deeper level. So I can't even get in the headspace of doing this because it's not something I naturally do, but you see online that there are mountains and mountains of fan art about certain things. And some of the fan art is spectacular because the artists take it in their own direction. They use their own specific voice with it and expand on it. And some of it is just rote creations of what is in the show. And that stuff, I really don't understand what they're doing. And it doesn't even matter if they've been doing it for a long time. The quality doesn't change. The content doesn't change. It's just, I saw this in the show and therefore I drew it. And then I saw this other thing and I drew it. And they seem to go nowhere. It's very, very odd. Also, I suppose if you're copying something not for the style, not for the thing that is enjoyable about it, but just to reproduce something like it, that's probably a bad idea. The only example that's coming to mind, though, unfortunately doesn't work, which is like Wizard School. Wizard School is probably the best standalone idea I've ever heard because it works no matter what genre you put it in. But something like, okay, if you're going to copy Rick and Morty, so you have an old man scientist and you have his nephew or grandson rather, and you go on adventures and you copy that superficiality, that's not what makes that show interesting or enjoyable. Those are just superficial details. Instead, you should be thinking about, why is this funny? Why does this work in animation? What's enjoyable about it? Take that stuff away. Steal like an artist, right?
Yeah, so you're against a lack of analysis.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're enjoying it, think about why.
Yeah.
If you don't enjoy it, think about why and avoid that stuff.
Yeah.
It's pedantic copying that really doesn't make much sense. Rick and Morty's inspired by Back to the Future, which is itself inspired by sci-fi. Probably, what was it, Quatermass that we watched at one of our screenings?
Mm-hmm. Sherman and Peabody. There's
yes,
another one.
Yes, absolutely. That kind of gentleman adventurer scientist, you know?
Yeah.
Or it could have even been inspired by Johnny Quest, now that I think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, the time machine, H.G. Wells.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Jules Verne. There you go. I mean, going all the way back to Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
So, yeah, copying without any analysis, copying without thinking, why do I like this? What do I want from this? It doesn't really serve you in any way. It doesn't serve anyone. And then showing other people is like doubly futile. So you copied something exactly from this show in a poorer way because, you know, of course it is. And then showed everyone else. But why? Why did you show everyone else? You're not trying to say anything with it.
Right.
Or, you know, illuminate us somehow. I don't get it.
So I have to ask, do you think pedantically copying without analysis, do you think fan art ever fits into this category?
It definitely does. But I will say that your pencil mileage, it can stack up in interesting and startling ways. I've seen where people were big fans, for instance, some people I went to school with of superheroes, and they drew lots and lots and lots of superheroes. But then they started to, almost through osmosis, understand what good design was for comic books and what good line work looked like. I think they couldn't help themselves but analyze a little bit and learn, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's poison. But an attitude of, I'm just going to draw this thing this way because I like this thing, is a very closed attitude. Whereas what they were trying to do is learn to draw. And so, yeah, they had their thing that they liked, but it was influencing their learning. It was giving them things to shoot for and things to ponder and question. It became more like master copies for them.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you guys talked about fan art because I'm the one who usually gets in trouble for saying this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to ask Tabor first.
Yeah. I've seen beautiful fan art, but usually it's beautiful because it doesn't look like the show. It looks like that artist's work.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes it.
Exactly.
Great. There's definitely value in that.
Yeah.
So, Steve, let's move on to your part. Could you talk about the other use for reference, being the more conceptual use?
Okay. Before I start here, I'm going to have to apologize in advance a little bit. Number one, whenever I talk about the kind of reference that I'm going to be talking about, I get excited because this is what Animation Resources is, and this has been my passion for the past 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I tend to get carried away. And I'm normally a really grounded, practical person. You know, I'm listening to everything Tabor says, and it's all 100% correct, and I agree with it. And I don't usually engage in hippy-dippy poetic philosophizing. I'm a producer, and it's my job to have my feet on the ground. But when it comes to reference and learning, I recognize that there's more to it than just a direct action and reaction. There's an aspect of it that's like sunshine helping and rain helping a tree to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You don't directly see the effects of the sun and rain, but those things are vital to make the plant flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm talking about sunshine and flowers. And you can bring out the straitjacket if you want. But let's see if I can drag myself down to earth a little bit more. Before I talk about reference specifically, I want to break down the basic steps to creativity. I was talking to a really famous cartoonist who'd never gone to art school, totally self-trained. And I mentioned to him that there were techniques for becoming creative, learning creativity. And he scoffed at me and he said, I never did anything to be creative. I just am.
Mm-hmm.
So I explained to him what the three steps are. And when I was done, he admitted that he did all of those three things without ever even thinking about it. So he just naturally stumbled across the three steps to creativity. So here you go. The three steps to creativity are number one, The primary source of inspiration for all artists is the observation of real life. You can write that down in your sketchbook. That is words to live by. The artist has to reflect what goes on around him, interpret what he sees, like what we were talking about earlier about you're not just creating a exact copy of something, you're adding something from yourself to it.
Yeah.
When you close yourself off to the world and you live in your own bubble, you start falling into ruts. They're like formulas. You know, you say the exact same things you've already said before. You do the same things. You create the same things you've seen before. Bakshi would go into Skid Row bars and talk with people. Mm. Just bums in a bar. Mm-hmm. A Hokusai would go to shipyards and watch the people there as they unloaded the fish and fixed their nets and worked hard at the end of the day and then hung out and got drunk. Mm-hmm. A group of friends of mine, after work, used to go to coffee shops at midnight because the people who came out to coffee shops at 2 a.m. had really unique skull shapes, which you never see anywhere else.
That's interesting.
They'd sit and draw, you know, the head shapes and show them to each other and go, look at that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So there are a million ideas in the world, and most of them aren't in your head yet. So you have to open yourself up.
This reminds me of like a Mark Twain quote. I think it was Mark Twain, but travel is fatal to prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I think that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the more people you see, the more things you see, the more life you experience.
Yeah.
The more you can put in animation. And if you make animation about animation, you end up with talking dogs and princesses and exactly what's wrong with animation.
Yeah, where everyone has a fedora and a briefcase, even though I've never seen someone in real life with either of those things.
Right. Yeah, and every cop has that giant rounded hat, you know, yeah. And a great big star on it. And these are things that aren't really real. They're cartoon conventions.
Just a symbol.
And cartoon conventions are really boring. Real life is more surprising and entertaining than things that other people have done to death.
Definitely.
So the second of the three steps to creativity is ideation. And we talked about this in a previous podcast. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to think outside the box and come up with a million different solutions to a problem. When I went to design school, they drummed a little mantra into my head. Your first idea is your worst idea. Mm-hmm. They say that to us over and over and over again. The way to come up with a great idea is to come up with a million ideas, a million bad ideas. They can even be crazy and totally impractical, because a bad idea or a crazy and impractical idea might lead to a solution to the problem that you haven't even thought of. Mm-hmm. So if you have a million ideas spread out in front of you, odds are a few of them in there are pretty fantastic. And much better than the one you would have settled on if you'd just gone with your first inclination. And I see people who come up with ideas for shows or something, and they want to pitch, and they only pitch one show. And what they should be doing, you know, an animator isn't hired to be the creator of a show because of the one show that he created. Mm-hmm. He's hired because he can create.
Yeah.
And once you've done that one show, the next thing they're going to say is, what else have you got? So the first thing you should do if you want to create a show of your own is to go out and make 50 shows have all of these ideas in your pocket. Mm-hmm. Then you know which one you want to develop and which one you want to go forward with. And you might find 10 years down the road, you look back and say, hey, that's a pretty good idea. And you take it and you're now in a position where you can do something with that.
I have a theory to expand on that. I want to see what your guys' opinion is, that I'm not so sure there's any such thing as a good or bad idea at all. It's just the potential you see and the practical application you see for it. Because when I just think about what the idea behind most popular things is, it's very plain. And it has very little potential all by itself. It was what the creators did with it that mattered so much. Like, Mario is an Italian plumber that goes into the sewer and fights turtles. That's ridiculous. That's nothing, right? But then they made this very enjoyable thing out of it. You know, there are some universal conflicts, like, you know, hunter and prey, like Bugs Bunny. But if I just say a hunter and a rabbit fight with each other, that's nothing. It's all about the humor and the specific way that they have that conflict that made it so good. And so I'm not so sure the idea is anything, but you see potential.
I agree 100%. I think the an idea, in quotes, given to someone whose idea that wasn't, isn't really anything.
Yeah, you can't exchange them.
Yeah,
because it's the way that it's going to be done that is the important, the ineffable part, the
right
part you can't describe.
Yeah, exactly, the part you can't describe. And an idea, the way we're talking about it, is something that we're putting into words.
Right.
Here's my theory on that. My definition of what a good idea is an idea that leads to a million more.
Mm-hmm.
Along the same line.
Sure.
I remember I was in a post-production session on the Bjork video that I produced.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how the next show we were doing was going to involve Hanna-Barbera characters. And we were saying, you know, what are we going to do? Because, you know, they've been done to death. You know, what do you do that's different?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, maybe Boo Boo can get, you know, sick of being a good little bear, rip off his tie and throw it on the ground.
Yeah.
And say, I'm tired of acting like a man. I want to become an animal in the forest. And John said, oh, that's an idea. And he jumped on it. And all of a sudden, 10 more things along the same lines. And all of a sudden, he had the entire cartoon.
Yeah.
Just one little nut of an idea that takes you in a direction that leads you into 50 more directions.
Mm. Yeah.
That along mm-hmm. the same way. That's a good idea is an idea that spawns more.
Yeah.
That's my definition of it.
Yeah, and I like the idea that a bad idea can lead to good ideas because it doesn't need to be good. It can just be inspirational.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Clearly, this thing that I'm saying is not going to work, but doesn't it open up this avenue of investigation? That can be great.
Yeah, that's what Steve was saying about, you know, your ideas can be totally impractical. Of course, you're not going to pursue that, but what it might lead to
right.
is something.
I guess I started pursuing that angle because my students were always so shy about brainstorming and their ideas. And so I would try to intentionally come up with bad ideas in front of them, in front of the class. and you can't do it. You just can't do it. You come up with something and then they go, oh, wait, no, that could work because of this and that. And I go, well, shit, let's try another one. I'll try a worse one. And then they could always find a way that it could be turned into a good thing. Like, well, see, you got nothing to be afraid of.
I told this story before, but I went to design school, mm-hmm. and in first class of class with a old-time Italian designer, Nathan Shapiro was his name, great, great designer. Mm. First day of class, he swept into class, stood at the podium, and said, this is your first project for this class. And he handed out papers, and he read off the paper. You know, you will do this. This is your problem. Solve this problem. Draw it up this way. Put it on the board. And when I come into class next time, I have them all pinned up on the board and ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just left. And it was like 5 minutes of class on our first day. And we're like, what is this? So we all went home and we, you know, followed his instructions and drew up a solution to the problem he'd given us and pinned them up on the board. And he came in and he looked around and he said, this is very good. Okay, now what I want each of you to do is to go home and come up with 100 more solutions to the exact same problem.
Wow.
And that was his way of teaching us, you know, first idea is your worst idea.
Yeah.
Right.
So getting back to the steps to creativity, the mm-hmm. third one, and this is the important one because this is actually our topic for today,
mm-hmm.
is to expose yourself to a broad spectrum of artistic creativity.
Mm.
Now, this particular truism is a doozy. It's huge. It's immensely impractical on the surface. And here's where I risk turning into a flower child again. So let's focus just on number three for the rest of the time here.
Yeah.
Open yourselves up to something you haven't experienced before. Okay. Now, I can only speak for myself, so I'll tell you about my journey, and I promise not to call it a journey again, because that sounds like a new age religion or something. But when I was in college, I took a music appreciation course. It was led by the conductor of the local community orchestra, and the guy was hopeless as a teacher, but he just basically turned on a record player in every class session and told us to read a chapter in the book. And I came out of it with a bunch of names and dates, but not much of an understanding of the music. Mm. And it certainly hadn't soaked in and become part of my consciousness. Mm-hmm. But the class gave me enough to let me know that there was something to classical music that was worth exploring. So I decided to do that on my own. I followed a few ground rules. At first, I didn't make any effort to like anything. I made a point not to decide what I didn't like too. Mm-hmm. My goal was just to expose myself to it, try to figure it out, and understand why people think this is so great. Mm. I took a bunch of names of the regular suspect composers: Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, Tchaikovsky, Chopin, Stravinsky. I checked records out of the library and copied them onto cassettes. And, you know, everyone here probably doesn't know anything about this, but yes, the public library did have LPs back in the olden days. They were all beat up, but they had tens of thousands of them to choose from. And I listened to everything through once, and I read the liner notes on the back of the album cover to learn who the composers were, what the world that they lived in was like. I read about the structure of the works. I figured out what a sonata form was, the difference between a concerto and a symphony, or a scherzo and a largo, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And as I listened, I thought about it, and things would start standing out to me that interested me. When I found something like that, I would follow it like the branch of a tree.
Can I ask you real quick before you go on, what inspired you to do that in the first place? Like, why did you start doing it?
Curiosity?
I think that's got to be it, right?
Yeah, because you just figured, oh, there's something to this classical music. I don't understand what it is yet, so let's...
Yeah, sort of like why you might click through Wikipedia articles for an hour and a half. Like, mm-hmm. just curiosity, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I do that all the time. People say, this is really, really good. And I ask them, why is this good? You know, tell me why. Explain to me what's really good about this. You know, and then I'll watch that show. You know, mm-hmm. okay, I'll give it a chance. And then, you know, I'll try to find the things in it that they found. I do this with other things, you know, movies, dance, everything, right?
Yeah.
So in music, when I found something that I'd like, I would chase it down. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I initially really liked Tchaikovsky. The Pathetique Symphony just jumped right out to me, and Marchislav and a bunch of other things. Tchaikovsky was a Russian composer from the 19th century. So I said to myself, okay, what other 19th century Russian composers were there? And that led me to Rimsky-Korsakov, Glinka, Mussorgsky, Rachmaninoff. Mm-hmm. All that led me to other related things. And I had no set path to follow. When you go to school, you've got a curriculum, and I didn't want a curriculum. What I wanted to do is I wanted to learn just by following breadcrumbs wherever they led me, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't forcing myself to like it or not like it. I was just trying to accept it and understand it. I knew that if I didn't understand it, well, you know how those Roomba robot vacuum cleaners work? anybody have one of those?
I did, but I hated
it. I've seen them plenty of times.
Yeah, we had one. We turned it off because it drove us nuts.
Yeah.
But the way those things work is they don't have any set pattern of how they move around your room. They use what's called the drunken sailor approach. And the idea is that they propel themselves around randomly. They bump off the furniture. They bump off the walls. They turn around, go the other way, every which way. But by doing that, eventually they hit every spot in the whole room.
Yeah.
And that happened to me with classical music. All of a sudden, I realized that I didn't know everything by any means, but I had a really good lay of the land and enough to have some favorites now and enough understanding to be able to research more intelligently.
So you didn't go in search of something in particular. You just went searching because the searching is pleasurable.
And I knew that what I was looking at was good because it's generally, you know, accepted Beethoven is a great composer.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know why Beethoven was a great composer.
I guess that's what's so good about the past is that it's curated for the most part. you know, the greats of literature or music are the greats for some reason, you know, people preserve them. So you can be sure.
Yeah, it's boiled down.
Yeah.
The dross is gone now. You know, it just the good stuff survive time. Everything else gets faded away.
Yeah.
So one of the composers that I liked was George Gershwin. And he did something called American Paris. He did a piece called Rhapsody in Blue. Mm-hmm. And that incorporated jazz rhythms into classical forms. Now, listen to this, and I really liked what I heard. You know, and I could see the aspect of it that was different from classical music. But I didn't know anything about jazz. So I tuned into an FM station. Back then, they would have college, maybe they still have them, college radio stations that would have some old guy with a record collection. He'd come in, and he'd play a program on the history of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in a sound house doing film transfer for commercials. And I do all my work from like 4 a.m. until around 10 a.m. And after that, I had nothing else to do. So I used the sound equipment. I would pop a cassette in and find good radio shows and tape the radio shows so I could do the same thing that I did with classical music. And I decided I'd do this with jazz. So I'm listening to this radio show, and a song comes on called Some of These Days, and it's by Cab Calloway.
Mm.
And it completely blew my mind, right? To use another hippie phrase. It had energy, it had momentum, it had an infectious rhythm, huge dynamics, and rapid-fire scatting. And it was as fun as a Betty Boop cartoon,
mm-hmm.
which made sense because Cab Calloway guest starred in some of the Betty Boop cartoons. So I walked over to the local record store, and I asked the guy, do you have any Cab Calloway records? He said, down that row in the back under the divider called Harlem Jazz. Now, bingo. I now had a name for what I was looking for.
Mm.
So I followed the branches of Harlem Jazz. Pretty soon I was listening to Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller. That led me to big band swing,
mm-hmm.
which led to bop, which mm-hmm. led to Dixieland, modern jazz. Pretty soon I had the lay of the land of jazz too.
Yeah.
I discovered a band leader named Machito, who did something called Afro-Cuban jazz, which led me to Cuban music and Latin music.
Nice.
Now, can you see what's happening here? By using the drunken sailor technique, I was becoming pretty well versed in music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And music taught me a few important things. Number one, music is a universal language. We may not be able to be born able to read a book or even understand a poem, but even babies have a basic understanding of music.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing a story about a woman who listened to Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run nonstop when she was pregnant.
Hmm.
And after a baby was born, if the baby started crying, all she had to do is pop on the boss and the kid would be happy and quiet. And I bet that kid is in his 30s and he still listens to Springsteen and doesn't even know why he likes his parents' music.
Yeah.
That may be why I like Tchaikovsky's, because maybe my mom was listening to that
sure.
when I was insider. I don't even know.
Wow.
So music is like mathematical patterns. It's abstract. It's objectively beautiful. You don't have to know anything about it to appreciate it. That makes it a really good place to start. It's different than books or art. Music can't really tell a story like a book or a painting can.
Hmm.
It isn't narrative,
yeah.
but it's got a direct connection to your emotions.
Yeah, definitely.
So once you understand music and connect with it, then you can apply what you've learned to not only other forms of music, because I found that what I learned from classical music told me something about country music. What I learned about country music told me about ethnic music, and you know, and so on and so on. But as you learn about one kind of art, it teaches you something about other forms of art.
Yeah.
And as an animator, your job may be to draw SpongeBob, but that's not who you are, right?
Yeah.
You're a filmmaker. Filmmaking involves all the arts. It involves theater, acting, graphic design, sound, music, color, lighting, dance, movement, even architecture and perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So animation is the conglomeration which is a great word, conglomeration of all the arts. Mm-hmm. And you can't be a good animator without a basic understanding of what all these art forms are capable of.
Yeah,
I do like the idea of learning about other art forms outside of your own and see how they compare and contrast. And it sounds like a daunting task, this drunken sailor technique. There's so much content out there, just centuries worth, across so many art forms. So how do you know where to start?
Don't you just start where you want to? Just whatever's fun?
Yeah,
pretty much. And you divide it up into achievable chunks, because you can't start saying, I want to know everything there is about classical music. Because, you know, that's like saying, okay, I want to become 50 feet tall. You can't just do that. Like you say, you don't set a specific goal. You just explore. Mm-hmm. You pick a starting point that everybody says is great. It doesn't matter which starting point. If they say it's great, okay, that's a good place to start. Mm-hmm. Expose yourself to it. Don't judge it. Just try and figure it out. Pretty soon, once you've got the lay of the land, that will tell you what your next step is. Mm. And you follow it out like branches on a tree. When you hit a dead end, double back, and you'll have five more branches to follow.
Yeah.
So the world of creativity, again, I'm doing all these pie in the sky analogies and stuff, and it doesn't sound practical, but it actually is. The world of creativity is like a spider web, okay? Everything's connected to everything else. And the more you learn, the more you realize what else you can't wait to learn about.
Yeah.
So if you have nothing in your head, you think, gosh, I'm bored, I've seen everything. But the more you learn and the more you know, the more you realize how much you need to know that you don't know yet. Now, you might think that your head will become full of stuff and nothing else will fit in. But it's the exact opposite of that. The further you go with filling your head, the more there is to fill your head with. And warning, again, I'm about to go hippie again. The more you comprehend, the more you can comprehend, okay? Everything you learn opens up a new game level that's bigger than the one before. Yeah. And it's never ending until you die.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe it even goes on beyond that.
It sounds like a lifestyle rather than a practical skill.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a lifestyle, and it isn't anything external from you. It's all inside you.
Yeah.
And here I go off the deep end again. Johann Sebastian Bach, when he was 14 years old, he was awarded a scholarship at a music school. But the school was 300 miles away from where he lived. Now, they didn't have buses and trains and cars back then. Bach walked 300 miles to get there.
Jeez.
Now, you may think that having the internet with the accumulated knowledge of mankind right there at your fingertips might give you an advantage over older artists who had to go to great lengths like Bach to expose themselves to new things. But that isn't the case. Imagine what Bach would think if he knew that a medium capable of bringing the entire world to the entire world was being used to distribute pictures of what people had for dinner, or cute videos of cats, or skateboarders falling off things, or talking about how awful things are on social media and looking for sympathy, right? You've got the whole world on your doorstep, but like they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Yeah.
You can lead a person to the internet, but you can't make them think.
In some ways, I think that ubiquitous nature of information is what makes people take it for granted. It's everywhere. It's all the time. It's right at your fingertips. It's instantaneous. So it doesn't seem valuable. But that's not the case. Like, just because something happens all the time doesn't make it any less of a miracle. Like, you know, children being born. Or just because something is everywhere doesn't mean that it's not wonderful, you know, and essential, like air.
You know, you're really good at this, Tabor. You got it.
It only sounds hippie, you know. It really is very down to earth and practical.
When I was a kid, my parents bought this huge encyclopedia set, right?
Oh yeah.
This is what you had before you had the internet. Every house had a set of encyclopedias. Groilers, there were a whole bunch of different brands of them. In any case, it was alphabetical, so you'd say, okay, animation, get the A book and go down to animation, read it.
Yeah.
You know, I had this thing sitting on the shelf. I don't think I cracked it more than two or three times. And the only reason I did that was because it was an assignment in class.
Mm, yeah.
Now, when you have the accumulated knowledge of mankind in front of you, it's kind of the sort of thing, I'll get to that later, right?
Yeah.
But when you say, I'm just going to take this little small nugget, someone says, this is a really good composer, someone says, this is a really good painter, or someone says, this director's movies, Alfred Hitchcock makes great movies. Okay, I'm going to watch a few Alfred Hitchcock movies. When you get that little nut, you know, that little tiny achievable chunk, then you can actually start spreading out your tree branches and end up actually absorbing that entire reference library and more.
Yeah.
So there is actually a meaning of life aspect to all this. A lot of people focus on just one thing, and that may be good for normal people, like dentists, accountants. You know, you don't want a brain surgeon who has a million interests, right? You want them to be the best brain surgeon they can be. So it makes sense not to divide your attention away from your focus if you're someone like that. But an artist is different. An artist's job is to be open to the world and reflect it like a mirror, while adding their own spin to it by means of their creativity. And you can't be a great animator just looking at animation.
Yeah.
Or even worse, just looking at one kind of animation.
Oh.
My style is, I do Disney Princess style, or I do anime, or I do a wacky Warner Brothers and that kind of thing.
Mm.
You know, I've got a theory on quality that I'll share with you. And you know, this is no great insight on my part. You've heard it before. 90% of everything is crap. Okay, here's a philosophy, right? Sure. Let's assume this is true.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that 10% of everything is great.
Uh-huh.
Now, why be a specialist on one area, only interested in one kind of thing? Because you're going to burn through the 10% pretty fast and be spending most of your time on the 90% of the crap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better to be like a butterfly, right? And here we go, hippie again. Like a butterfly flitting from flower to flower with peace, love, and granola, and just sampling the best that the world has to offer. Now, I'm making a joke here, but my point is completely serious.
Yeah.
Why do you expose yourself to crap?
Mm.
When you expose yourself to the greatness of culture, all kinds of culture, the best of novels and poetry and music, art, dance, sculpture, drama, comedy, architecture, movies. You're creating your own world from the best of what mankind has to offer.
Mm.
You're packing your head with creativity and your culture, right? And cultures all over the world. That will inform who you are the same way that the people you surround yourself define you as a person. Now, you hear people say, you know, the people that you surround yourself are the person you become.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely true. If you hang out with nasty, you know, negative people, you're going to become negative yourself. If you surround yourself by successful people who are more successful than you are, smarter than you are, more creative than you are, happier than you are, all those things will soak into you, and it will fill you up with happiness and success and creativity and intelligence.
Yeah.
But if you fill your head with junk, you'll reap just what you sow.
Yeah.
Now, being an artist, here's more meaning of life. Being an artist isn't just about you and the time that you're spending here on Earth. Art is a way to achieve cultural immortality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think Rembrandt, Frank Lloyd Wright, Giuseppe Verdi, Fred Astaire, these are names that are going to live forever. Even if your name is forgotten, your work can live on and represent you, like the Sphinx or the pyramids in Giza. We don't know who designed them, but good grief, everybody in the world knows what they are.
Mm.
So there's more to life than just accumulating knowledge.
Yeah.
The next step beyond that, you've absorbed it, now share it with others.
Mm.
If you share your creative influences with other artists, right? Artist to artist, look at what inspires me, what inspires you. You know, this should be what you do for pleasure 90% of the time. Share your influences, share the things that excite you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm big on Japanese art right now, and everybody who knows me is getting Japanese art shared with them too. When you do that, it raises the whole art form up, and it raises the artists around you, because as the art form rises, it rises like the tide, improving you yourself. Now, here's an example of the tide rising and carrying everybody up with it. You know, we've got B movies and we've got A movies, right?
Yeah.
But in the golden age of Hollywood, you know, we had Cecil B. DeMille epics. We had Gone with the Wind. We had all of these big A pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that those are masterpieces or whatever. And, you know, they're great. But there was, at the same time those were being produced, there were B pictures being made too. Film noir, crime dramas, westerns, horror films, cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, these were looked at as program fillers with no competition for the big pictures, right? But many of those B pictures are A pictures to us now.
Mm.
Casablanca was not considered an A picture. Casablanca was a B picture.
Huh.
Mm.
Ronald Reagan was going to star on it until they put Humphrey Bogart in it.
Wow.
You know, it was not going to be a really huge picture, but it turned out to be that way because the whole industry was operating on a higher level back then.
Yeah.
The reason the industry was operating on a higher level back then was because the whole filmmaking process was just sparking and shooting out ideas, and people were sharing ideas with each other. Directors were going from studio to studio and working with different people. Every person was raising everybody else around them.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So when you share something with other people share back.
Yeah.
You infect those people with your excitement, and they infect you. Now, I'm pals with Bakshi, and when I first met him, I'd seen his films, and I had an idea of what kind of person it was. He's from Brownsville, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thick New York accent,
mm-hmm.
right? He's huge. He was an ex-boxer. You know, I have nothing in common with that. I'm from L.A., you know, I go a lot, you know. I go, you know, a lot. I'm nothing like a New Yorker ex-boxer.
Mm-hmm.
But when I sat down and started talking with him, even though we came from two completely different places, we realized that we were birds of a feather.
Mm.
Ralph went through the exact same drunken sailor process of the arts that I did.
Mm.
You know, you think, you sit down and talk to Ralph that he's going to talk about, oh, I don't know, the sorts of things that are similar to the films he made, maybe Frazetta and stuff like that. And yeah, he does talk about Frazetta and science fiction and things like that.
Yeah.
But he's also amazing at the history of art. He can tell you about painters that you've never even heard about before.
Yeah.
And you go look at it and you go, holy cow, why didn't I know about that before? Well, we had a lot of appreciation of music and arts and movies and that sort of thing in common. And he had some things I hadn't hit yet. And I had some things that he hadn't hit yet. And whenever one of us were talking on the phone or something, one of us discovers that we know something the other doesn't know about yet, we get excited. We, you know, oh boy, I figured I got something you don't know,
yeah.
right? So we'd start sharing new inspiration and new ideas is one of our biggest joys as being friends.
You know, what's cool about what you're saying is that it's a joy to meet someone who's like you, and it's a joy to meet someone who's nothing like you. They're both a joy. They're just
yes.
a joy in different ways.
And that's looking into, this is another, here we go on to meaning of life. You have to look past the surface of people to who they really are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say, oh, Ralph is mean, Ralph is a terrible person to work for, all that. I instantly loved Ralph Bakshi because I could look past that surface.
Yeah.
You know, most LA people can't deal with New Yorkers, right? Yeah. We feel threatened by them. I wasn't threatened. I was looking at him going, this is a guy who makes really cool movies, right? I want to find out how he did it.
You found the similarities. You found what was like you in him, even though he's so different, you know, you bridged exactly. that connection. You're lighting my brain up, Steve. I'm remembering like when I went to school in San Bernardino, I met a bunch of people who did graffiti art and still did it. They'd go out and tag trains and stuff. And I'm a white kid from the suburbs and I never thought of anything like that. But when they talked about it, they were talking about art. They were talking about the joy of expressing something and design and pushing their ability. And I didn't have to know why they did what they did, where they came from to appreciate that. And so we got along great.
Exactly.
You know, I'm drawing goofy cartoons and they were doing that. And it's like we were the same kind of person.
And you can show them things in cartoons that they don't even have a concept of, right?
And they had a hell of a lot. Yeah.
Elevating each other's art forms.
Yeah. I loved it. It was great.
Well, the great thing is that everything we learn leads to five more things to learn about.
Yeah.
Ralph has a few years of head start on me, but he's still learning and growing. And he's in his 80s, and he's still learning and growing. You know, I aspire to be like that. I want to keep learning until I die.
Yeah.
You know, overall, I'm a happy person. Okay, this is the meaning of life part again. I'm content. And that isn't because I haven't experienced hardship. I've had life struggles. I've had huge losses in my life. But I feel that I have a purpose. I'm plugged in to some of the greatest things mankind has ever created. And I share it with the people around me. I'm not sitting in my bubble feeling sorry for myself and shutting other people out because they're different than me. And if you want my theory on the meaning of life, and this applies not just to art, but everything, my theory is go out in the world and share yourself and everything you know with everyone you can, and learn everything you can from the people around you.
Yeah. I want to give you a breadcrumb right now then, Stephen, because you're reminding me of Alan Watts a lot. He's a philosopher, and he has this contention that life is a conversation between you and the universe. You do your thing, it does its thing, right? And back and forth it goes. It changes you, you change it. And that's kind of what you're saying.
And what the universe is, in our case, as artists, is culture.
Yeah, especially as people.
I watched a documentary, and the documentary said, this documentary is about history, but history is the continuity of culture, and culture is the expression of art. Yeah. There's nothing that represents period of time, a group of people, a place, an ethnicity, a cultural aspect than art. Art is the biggest reflection of who we are that we have.
Yeah.
So us communicating with art and as much art as we can possibly absorb is our job as artists. We need to interface with art. That's the job. It isn't to draw SpongeBob. It isn't to, you know, sit down and do these composites or something. Our job is to absorb the world and change the world and become immortal along with culture.
Sort of being the voice box of culture. You know, we're sort of being the mouthpiece of it.
We are culture. Artists are the culture of, you know, we're reflecting, we're interpreting, and we're producing.
Yeah.
Which is what else is there to do? So, okay, I'm going to wipe the board. That's as far as I can go with philosophy. So it's time for a little bit of practical advice too, okay?
Okay.
All output with no input is not good.
Yeah.
You can't just constantly keep doing things the same way, to keep doing storyboards, to keep designing characters, to keep writing music, to keep making movies that are all the same. And the way that you are able to put variety in there is to open yourself and expose yourself to a lot of different kinds of creativity, because all that creativity will soak into you. So all output with no input is going to be a downhill path to not being creative anymore. Second, an artist is an artist first. Not an animator first, not a painter first, an artist first. Mm. An artist absorbs the world, processes it, puts it out there with their own unique spin on it. They're not recycling, they're not regurgitating, they're creating something new.
Yeah.
And okay, I'm going to say this real loud, okay? So everyone cover your ears. Walt Disney is dead. He's dead. He's dead. That's all that needs to be said. Make something else. Don't follow old, dead things. Make something new and vital that reflects what you see around you and who you are.
Yeah.
No more talking dogs. No more princesses. No more la, 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 la. None of that. Something new, please.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, here's another practical bit of advice. That was a really practical bit of advice for animators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another bit of practical advice. Taking from one medium and using it in another medium guarantees that you have to process it.
Mm.
Now, this is what we were talking about earlier with what's the line between copying and plagiarism. Modest Mussorgsky, a Russian composer, went to a show of paintings at a gallery, and he really liked them. So he created a piece of music, a program piece called Pictures in an Exhibition, where he described in music the feeling of each picture that he had seen.
Wow.
Now, what he created was so great that it stands apart from the pictures that inspired it. In fact, if you see the actual pictures that he based the music on, it's kind of a letdown. You know, the music is its own thing. It's been processed into something new and something huge and great.
Wow.
So if you are forced to process some creativity that you are using in your own work, you can become better than what you're imitating.
That's amazing.
If you copy, you can only be almost as good.
Yeah.
That is a truth, right? Write this stuff down, you know, because these are things that I've learned from all of the old artists that I've talked to. They all know this stuff. It isn't a secret.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's another truth. Taking from one time period or culture to another time period or culture guarantees that you have to process it too.
Mm.
This is not cultural appropriation. What this is, and it's not appropriating a time or a place, and it's not becoming what people were like in the past.
Mm.
You're processing it. And you're forced to process it when it's in another time and headspace, right? Another culture entirely. You have to process it if you want to make it something relevant to today. And this is why animation resources, people say, oh, you only like old things. No, that's not true. Animation resources focuses on older things and works from different cultures for a reason. Because you can't just reuse and copy a World War II gas rationing gag.
Yeah.
No one would understand it today. You can learn from the tools that were used to make that gag and that put across that gag and use the techniques that gave it expression and become great yourself. Mm-hmm. But you're saying something real. You're not imitating. So it's really good. You know, Hokusai lived in, what, 1830, 1820, and he was like 60 years old at that time.
Mm.
Hokusai has a million things to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes from a different culture that was even closed off to the West. He didn't even know anything about what was happening at the same time in Europe, because there was no communication between Japan and Europe at that time. So he's in as different a world as you can possibly be, but he has a million things to teach you because he's an artist.
Yeah.
And if you look at the things that make him great, instead of the fact that he's drawing a picture of a girl in a kimono, right? Not the content, the concept is what you learn from him. So here we go. Bias. A lot of people find bias is a huge stumbling block, and it shouldn't be, right? I've known people who only like one specific type of animation. or one kind of music or one period of art. They say the golden age was between these two dates and there's nothing else but that, right? They limit their own creativity by doing that. They couldn't create anything outside that box that they built around themselves. They call it good taste. But Pablo Picasso said, the chief enemy of art is good taste. So it's important to understand what bias is. Everybody, every human being on earth is born with bias. Bias is what helps us make decisions. We make them automatically without even thinking. When we wake up in the morning, we put on our slippers, we make our coffee, we eat some cereal, and then all of a sudden we go, wow, I just woke up. What have I done? Right? Oh, I've eaten. Okay. You know, you get through the day, you just kind of like run on autopilot sometimes.
Yeah.
And bias is what helps us do that. We make decisions. You know, we don't have to spend a half hour deciding what we're going to do. You know, what's the best way for me to go to work today? No, I'm just going to go the way I always go, right? Because that's the best way, right? It's bias, but what the heck? Okay.
So like familiar or automatic would be another way to kind of think of this?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's the things that we do, right?
Right.
Bias is also what makes us assume that fire is too hot to touch and pepper probably isn't good on ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely necessary. Bias moves us forward instead of being bogged down on deciding each and every little thing we do. Some decisions are important and we've got to try and eliminate bias, but bias helps us in all the little things that move us forward. So bias is a great thing, but it can also build walls around things. We can avoid things that might be important.
I've got an anecdote about this really quick because this makes a lot of sense.
Go.
Recently, my wife and I have been learning to cook Asian food because we're branching out a bit. She's a good cook. I am not a good cook. I've never been a good cook. But I can read instructions and I can follow directions and I can assist. And we were making yakisoba. And she said, okay, go ahead and boil these noodles. And I said, wait, it says on here, we should loosen them up and not boil them. We should just put them right in the pan. She's like, what? Because she'd always made European style noodles. And you boil them. You boil spaghetti noodles. So she never even thought to question the way that she prepared noodles. Noodles are noodles. But this is a totally different culture. And so we were able to figure out, oh, we'd been doing something wrong. We're getting slimy, wet yakisoba, which is disgusting, by the way. And instead, we now got nice, crispy, dry yakisoba, which is what you're looking for. But it was her bias, her ingrained knowledge of how to cook things right, that kind of made that a stumbling block.
And opening yourself up and considering possibilities and learning about different ways of doing things are the things that make you greater at everything you do.
Yeah.
I love cooking. Cooking is a whole other thing. You know what the difference is between a chef and a cook?
What?
A chef follows specific steps, always the same, to make consistent food like what you want in a restaurant, right? If you go in and buy spaghetti on one day and you go back the next day, it's got to be exactly the same spaghetti every time. That's a chef.
Yeah.
A cook kind of planes and moves around and improvises as they go. And I'm definitely a cook.
Yes, Steven's definitely a cook.
You're making me realize that the reason my wife and I cook well together is because she's a chef and I'm a cook then. Because if it doesn't go right, I like to use spices to fix it and mess with things and rearrange them. And she's uncomfortable with that because she learned how to cook rote from her mom and from her grandma. But then if it turns out well, we write that down into a new recipe for her. So it works out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll start cooking something and it's going to be one thing. And I get halfway through and I open the refrigerator and I see something in the back and I go, hey, you know, that might be good in there.
Yeah, just
and all of a sudden, it's a vegetable just became a main course.
Yeah.
You know, it's magic.
Cool.
So, you know, we can avoid things that might be important just because we're biased against them. We can look down on people who are doing great things because we just don't understand or appreciate what they're doing.
Yeah.
So it's important for an artist to look beyond personal bias, to be able to say, I'm not going to decide whether this is good or bad. There's a million ways to create art. be open to all of them, right? Mm. Feel free to have ways that work well for you, but those rules don't apply to other artists. And remain open to different ways of doing things. Don't close doors by liking or not liking something. That's allowing bias to put you in a cage. Now, you can judge. Now, here's the difference. Judging is okay. Judging is a process of critical thinking. You define a list of criteria, you apply it by means of observation and analysis, and you come to a decision whether this particular thing meets your criteria or not, right? Mm. Someone else may have a different set of criteria for judging and come to an entirely different conclusion, but that doesn't mean that one of you is right and one of you is wrong. Mm. You know, the truth is like a diamond with a million facets. It looks different from every angle. And if you're going to bypass your personal bias and look at it from a different point of view, you may have a better conception when you add that to what you already know and understand better what truth is. Mm. And that's what the greatest artists do. They reveal the truth in contrasts and contradictions, and all of those contrasts and contradictions define what truth is. They explore different ways of looking at something, different ways of thinking about it, different ways of feeling about it. You look at one image and you may get three different feelings out of it. That's art.
Yeah.
When you listen to music and it's not just sad, it's sad and it's hopeful, or it's sad and it's not hopeful. You know, there are all these layers of emotions in it. You can't create that kind of thing by following formulas and copying and not being open to the world. So don't dismiss anything until you've absorbed it. Then you can judge it based on quality criteria. But if you just build arbitrary walls, you know, I'm only interested in this. I'm only interested in anime. I'm only interested in Disney. If you do that, you'll miss a lot of great stuff that's coming at you from a completely different direction.
Yeah.
And that applies as far macro as you can go in your life, as far and wide as you can go. You know, you should be open to different kinds of people, different kinds of opinions, different kinds of music, art, culture, everything.
Well, this is something that I certainly in the context of art, but hopefully in all areas of life, like you just mentioned, something that I always try to put into practice. I never try to dismiss an artist or work of art until I've absorbed it as much as I can.
Yeah.
Like with the Animation Resources reference packs.
Oh, yeah.
The new reference pack coming out, all the anime and manga we're going to see, which is something I just kind of, for most of my life, dismissed as something I'm just not really into. And while it's still not my personal favorite art form, I recognize that there's probably a lot to learn from it. So for me, it becomes like studying rather than enjoying it as an audience member, which I guess is what artists are supposed to do anyway.
Yeah, you know, actually, this is kind of sad, and I don't want to make anybody disappointed, but being a part of an audience, being an audience member, is one of the first things that you lose as an artist. When I go to the theater, I can't sit and watch cartoons the way I did back when I was a kid. Back then, I was watching a duck get angry. Now, I see all the techniques that were used to make the duck get angry in a very expressive and specific way. So, it's different. Maybe it's better, maybe it's not. It's different.
I think it's better to be able to think about the grown man drawing a duck face and getting angry. I think that's far funnier.
Well, the funniest thing is to watch Sleeping Beauty, and when the prince meets Sleeping Beauty or Briar Rose in the forest,
yeah,
that's a love scene between
Milk Call and Mark Davis. And it's beautiful too. Yeah, I love that.
Oh, I never realized that.
Well, I've been blathering for quite a while, and I want to finish up here. But the last thing I want to talk about is curation, because that's an important part of sharing your discoveries with others. And it's something that I've been focused on in the last year. It's not enough to just throw something out the table and point at it. Hey, look at that. You know, you got to organize it. You got to provide context for other people to grab onto it and begin to experience and understand it. Reference is only useful when you have enough of a grasp on it to be able to break it down and categorize it.
Yeah.
That's how you shove it into the compartments in your head, right?
Yeah.
Until you do that, it's just raw facts or a random object without meaning. It's the job of a curator to accumulate and catalog without judging. Just like I did when I first started exploring classical music. The curator analyzes it, creates a package out of it that can be shared with someone else, explaining why it's important and pointing out aspects of it that deserve attention. I do that every 2 months in our reference packs for animation resources with the help of our advisory board, with people like Bakshi and Will Finn and Sherm Cohen and all the, and J.J. Settlemyer, all the great artists that are on our advisory board. These people are sharing with us things that they've accumulated and cataloged and found useful. I'm putting it all together into a reference pack and sharing it with you as a curator. So a curator is a creator of sorts. He's building meaning and creating value in a world that consists of a universe of good, bad, and ugly. You know, the whole world is random and dispersed. Like we said, 90% is crap, right? So a curator finds the good stuff and then creates the links between these things.
Yeah.
Like putting together a jigsaw puzzle and presenting what they've found clearly to the world. Once you see all of that laid out in front of you, you start realizing, hey, music is connected to animation, and animation is connected to design, right? All these things start connecting. In our modern times, where we're living with the internet and all that sort of stuff, we don't appreciate curation nearly as much as we should. A curator is not the same as a critic. A critic tells you something's good or bad. Right? Thumbs up, thumbs down, on a scale of 1 to 10. That stuff is bullshit. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
A curator tells you why something deserves your attention. A critic just tells you something, whether it's good or bad. Now, I've read things by animation historians that are completely wrong-headed. They can't see past their own nose because their bias is preventing them from understanding what they're looking at. I'm only interested in Warner Brothers, you know. I'm only interested in Fleischer. I'm only interested, you know. They're making no effort to see past their own personal likes and dislikes and biases. Okay, one more philosophical statement here, and then I'm done, okay? Here it is. You ready?
Sure.
Write it down.
Okay.
Opinions are like assholes. Everyone's got one.
That's a perfect note to end on.
I didn't end like a hippie.
Wait, no.
No, you didn't.
Isn't there more to it? And most of them stink?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Steve. And thank you, Tabor, for sharing all of your wisdom.
And don't forget, if you're not already, become a member of Animation Resources and you get unlimited access to a new reference pack every other month. These reference packs are all expertly curated by Steven and the Advisory Board of Animation Resources. They're full of material you'd never otherwise see. It's only $70 per year to be a member when you're a student and $95 per year for everyone else. For what you're getting, it really is a huge bargain. Go to animationresources.org/membership today to sign up. Again, that's animationresources.org/membership.